I think he probably had a medical scare and was forced to slim down drastically.
Anorexia?
Not quite anorexia, no. I think that's unlikely. That's the voice of Tony Gosling. Tony, usually the shy, retiring, short of an opinion. Let's see if we can extract a few words out of you. Come on, it's going to be hard work. What would you like to talk about today? Railways.
As usual.
Yeah.
Okay, so you finished playing me your train set this morning, zoomed down here and thought, well, we've got to talk about railways. Actually, there is, it's in the news today, sort of various deliberate leaks, as usual, from the government, you know, emails to the BBC. Whoops, we're very sorry about that.
What has been leaked? What's the essence of the leak?
Well, it's called the Rail Command Paper. It's going to be officially released this afternoon. And it sounds very grand, doesn't it? The Rail Command Paper. It's been put together by someone called Sir Roy McNulty, who was the chief executive of Short Brothers, who used to make aircraft in Northern Ireland, and that company failed under his leadership, so he's obviously thought to be the best person to design our railways for the future. And he was also, I think, chair of the Civil Aviation Authority. He's a director of the privatised Gatwick Airport, which is under investigation from the Competition Commission. So, I mean, he's a bit of a, you know, official suit.
A clean bill of health from Tony Gosling, then?
He's also vice chair of the Olympic Delivery Authority.
Okay.
So he's obviously had plenty of time over the last few months to make sure this is an excellent report, which is going to sort our railways out once and for all.
Well, it's all about costs, isn't it? Because there is it's a pretty universally agreed that the costs of running the railways in this country are much more than they should be, much more than our European counterparts, about 40% more. And that's why McNulty was brought in, to see if he could find ways of increasing the efficiency and reducing costs on the railways.
Yeah, but he wasn't allowed to say nationalise.
He wasn't, no. And I think that is the elephant in the room, really, isn't it?
Well, let's have a look at what's happened since the railways were nationalised in the 1990s, the mid-1990s, towards the end of the Major government, and before Labour took power in 1997. Let's have a look at some of the figures. If you go back to around about 1990, when it was still
British Rail,
the government subsidy for railways was annually 1.5 billion. Obviously, that's a lot of money, and they were saying at the time, this is far too much, we've got to privatise it and it will get less subsidy. Well, of course, the complete opposite has happened, and now the latest figures, which are for 2010, we're now subsidising it three times more, which is... How's your math?
Well, four and a half million?
Billion. This is not millions. This is thousands of millions of pounds of public money going to subsidise these privatised rail companies. And so the figure is now roughly £4.5 billion a year of public money going to subsidise. That's three times more than it was before it was privatised.
Okay, but can we factor in inflation there? I mean, surely that's a factor. It's not three times in real terms, is it?
It will. I mean, that's the actual figures. As a proportion, if you want to look at it like that, the proportion of the amount of money that the railways spend, which is actually supplied by a government subsidy, used to be, back in 1989, 20%.
Right.
It's now 40%.
Okay. So that's a doubling.
We've taken out the inflation. So, yes, it is roughly double.
Yeah.
We're paying now double what we used to for our railways. And also, of course, that's as the public, but also we're paying way more than double in fares, aren't we?
Indeed,
where is all that money going? Into this great big black hole?
Well, I think where it's going, there was some controversy a while back about the train leasing companies. Now, what probably most people don't know is that the companies that run the trains don't actually own the trains. They have to lease them from these train leasing companies. And
Leasing racket.
They have made quite a lot of money. But someone gave him a clean bill of health recently. But I'm sure that's not the whole story.
Well, the problem is we've got whole strata of ownership right throughout the rail. I mean, the railways were what built Britain's industrial past, really. I mean, you know, it was a very efficient system, and it was supplied a little bit more than cost when they built these railways. Of course, these new privatised companies, they haven't actually built anything, really. I mean, they do build a bit, but all of the infrastructure and everything was there for them, which they got for nothing. You know, they didn't have to pay for it all.
Well,
they've got this stuff. They were awarded contracts, franchises, yeah? You don't have to pay to get the franchise. Well, at least
you
pay a bit for the rail franchise. But
you do pay quite a lot, actually.
Yeah, but ultimately, there's a whole load... So what's happening is, I mean, are we in a situation where the government is actually subsidising these rail companies to then pay back to the government some sort of token fee for their franchise.
Well, I think your analysis is slightly wrong. I mean, clearly the train operating companies are privatised companies and they want to make a profit, but I don't think they're raking in, you know, I don't have the figures, Tony, perhaps you could look into this, their profit versus turnover. I suspect the profit would be relatively modest. The real problem, and you touched on it earlier, is the defragmentation, where you have so many different organisations running this thing, and for every organisation that deals with another organisation, there's contracts, there's lawyers, you know, there's admin that needn't be there, and I think that's really the you know, as I said, the elephant in the room. It's the defragmentation that, of course, no one will touch because no one wants to renationalise it. But that would solve that problem at a stroke.
Well, that's what the rail unions say. Bob Crowe from the RMT is saying exactly the same today, that fragmentation and profiteering is what's killing the railways. It's, you know, this is all really annoying because what they're planning to announce this afternoon is that the existing rules for how much the rail companies are allowed to charge passengers for rail tickets, well, I'm afraid that's all going to have to change, and we're going to be taking off a lot of restrictions on the keeping of fares down to a certain, fare increases down to a certain percentage. So what we're going to be seeing is both peak fares and off-peak fares, after having risen, I think, is it 9% at the beginning of January? Something.
No, it wasn't 9%. It was inflation plus 1%. So I think it was 6%.
Okay. But anyway, those figures, we're going to have increases this year again, where the rules, the regulation that was on rail companies that said they had to keep fares to increases it to a minimum, that's all going to go. So they're going to be able to charge a lot more for peak trains and also for off-peak trains.
Basically
sort of deregulation. That's what this thing is about.
Okay, but let me put to you one of Roy McNulty's arguments on this. We have a kind of two-tier pricing structure when it comes to peak trains. We have sort of basically peak and off-peak, don't we? And what happens is, he talks about the shoulder where there's a real problem. So you have the last peak train is fairly empty, and then the first off-peak train is rammed because that's when the cheaper tickets kick in. And what he's trying to do is sort of even out the pricing and demand to make it a bit more consistent. Now, that's fair enough, isn't it?
Well, I mean, the thing is that air transport fares, this is one of the things they're saying, is that a lot of the, because McNulty's from the aviation industry, and he's saying, oh, well, with aviation fares, we just let people charge what they want. Why can't we just do the same with the rail fares? And of course, there is an argument, a free market argument, that says, well, we should be able to charge much more for rail fares, particularly if businesses are picking up the bill and the individuals that are actually doing the travelling aren't paying these fares. They don't really care how much they pay because the company's picking up the tab. But I mean, I think that what this does is, of course, it penalises ordinary rail travellers, whether it's a commuter that has to pay their own fare above and beyond those who are on these expense accounts. And I also would disagree with you about that the fares are fairly simple in any way at all, because there's so many different types of fares in the mail.
No, I agree with that.
In the mail, James Black today is actually, it probably come out in tomorrow's mail because it's online today, is talking about buying a ticket being like being mugged. He's also saying,
but that's just about the price, isn't
the
it?
Ticking, but he's saying also that the ticket websites are like casinos. You can be there searching for the cheapest fare, and suddenly the fare you were about to buy leaps by like 20 quid just in the space of a few seconds, and you go to it again, and it's leapt by another 20 quid in a few seconds. And he said it's like playing a slot machine. You know, this is no way to run a railway, as they say. I mean, that's in the Mail. There's another article in the Mirror, on the Wirra website today, which explains that as part of these cuts, we're going to see probably something like 675 booking offices close across the country. The RMT are just announcing with other rail unions a campaign today called Save Our Stations, which is going to be as a result of that, basically saying that, you know, the stations are going to be dying if there's no booking offices. And this is a massive number of booking offices they're proposing to close here. The other thing is there's also going to be potentially anyway something like 12,000 job losses because of this these cuts that they're talking about now. Mr. McNulty's talking about. I mean, of course it makes sense if you've got somebody on the train who can actually you can actually buy your fare with, buy your ticket with, you may wonder, well, what's the point of having somebody actually at a station? Well, what it does, of course, is it massively increases the workload on the whoever it is that's got to go up this super overcrowded train and collect everybody's fare. And also, it decreases massively the security at the individual railway stations.
Yeah, yeah. I think you make a good point, actually, about that, you know, people want to feel secure at their station. The point about the ticket collectors, I just took the local train, the Seven Beach line, and you know, the ticket collector, because the stations are understaffed, he has to collect all the fares, and there's just no way he can do it. I mean, you know, people know that you can just hop on the train and get off. Probably,
can you?
Yeah.
God, oh, yeah. I might try that. Yeah, so yeah, Seven Beach.
Seven Beach.
How
yeah.
far can you get before the ticket inspector gets to you?
I couldn't possibly comment. It will vary from train to train, but you know, I'm sure I'm not the only one who has taken a free ride on that train in the past.
Maybe that's why it's become so popular. You know, it's become so overcrowded that the ticket inspector can't actually move down the train, everyone's travelling, well, apart from the people immediately next to the ticket inspector, travelling for nothing.
But there's a serious point as well, because it makes the, if the ticket collector can't get all the fares, that's really the only way I've got of recording the amount of people travelling on the train. So it makes it look like the train is less popular than it actually really is, and that has been, you know, I think used as a means of shutting down lines in the past. But just going back to McNulty, I mean, I think, you know, where I struggle with it, if McNulty's brief was to increase efficiency, you know, no one can argue with that. But for me, increasing efficiency means you provide the same service at less cost. That's not the same as cutting services, which is what he seems to be proposing with these, you know, these ticket inspector and so on, and downgrading stations.
Well, what they're trying to do is to not cut services, but just massively cut costs on the railways, which means ultimately getting rid of staff and also whacking up fares. So, you know, there's James Black's article in the Mail is pretty uncompromising. He's talking about the rail firms having a contempt for the travelling public, and he's reiterating right at the beginning of the article again that we have our highest fares in Europe and quite possibly anywhere in the world, which is why I think that this Save Our Stations. I mean, the other thing is there was an article in the Financial Times as well, on the Financial Times website today, which is reconfirming the reason for this report. Now, do you know that?
Go on, tell me. What's the conspiracy theory then?
It's not a conspiracy theory. Hang on, just let me get the actual quote. Two senior rail officials have told the Financial Times today the reason for this report today is HS2, and that is what is the funding of HS2, which is driving these rail cuts.
Right. Now, as a conspiracy theorist,
this is senior rail officials quoted in the Financial Times today.
I'm asking you a follow-on question. Okay. As a conspiracy theorist, what do you think is the hidden agenda behind HS2?
I think it's a racket, basically. It's a high-tech industry which will have fantastic maintenance contracts into the indefinite future, and we'll absolutely make a packet out of it. It's probably going to be almost entirely a foreign thing as well, and it's about introducing an incredibly expensive new technology that we actually don't really need.
So, why would the Conservative government, which generally speaking doesn't like public spending, commit itself to future large amounts of public spending?
Well, it seems to take massive amounts of public money and give it to its mates. I mean, we've seen here, you know, the train operating companies and the railway industry in general is now being, you know, basically it's this corporate welfare. £4.5 billion every year is going into these companies' profits and into the shareholders' pockets. So, I mean, that's the reason. I think the other thing is, if anyone wants to look all this stuff up, which is really the entire sort of background to what's going on with the railways and public subsidy of the railways over the last 20, 30 years, it's a really good article by Ben Chu, that's CHU, on the Independence blog. I think he's a blogger in the Independent, and he also had an article about this report which came out last year in the Independent newspaper itself. But Ben Chu has done a fantastic, you know, summary of the way that the public are now paying three times more for the railways than they did before it was privatised. And, of course, most of that money is just going into the pockets of shareholders and fat cat bosses of people like First Great Western.
Tony, we'll have to leave it there. We're running out of time. But you brought me a book, I believe. Is that right?
Okay, here you go.
the Great Railway Conspiracy.
It's been withdrawn from the library services of East Sussex.
Right, okay.
Officially, with a proper stamp here.
Okay.
Back in... Okay, she doesn't actually say. No, 1992.
But it's so the background to beaching and so on, is it?
It is, yeah. It's and, of course, it's interesting to see the way that the unions have reacted to this, the rail unions today, you know, making sure that they're absolutely adamant about what's going to happen with this, which is they are going to have a campaign to stop it. And that is because the whole reason for beaching in the early 1960s, reshaping Britain's railways, was an attack on the unions, because they saw, the Conservative government at the time, saw the railways as a strategic asset that they had to have control of. And the railways, railway unions, had been striking. You know, it had meant that things like the coal supplies for power stations were running down, people couldn't get to work, and over a space of 2 weeks, this railway strike in 1955 made the Conservative government determined to break the power of the unions on the railways, and also to, you know, line their own pockets by diverting any government money into the pockets of Ernest Marples, who was a motorway builder and also transport minister. So, you know, I think we need to go back to beaching to really get a vision of how our railways could work and should work in the future.
Don't make them like that anymore.
They
do
don't,
they?
Do they? That's the voice of Billy Quain, my regular arts guest.
I've been watching a lot of telly, that's what I've been doing. Jeremy Paxman has started doing a series on Empire and how Britain has ended up the way it is today, with, you know, little pockets of colonial, as we've seen with Prince Harry's tour of the Caribbean, this kind of lasting post-colonial influence around the place, and of course the simmering difficulties with the Falklands or Las Malvinas, which is still going on, and it's a little bit of a history of that. The old enemies, the first colony was Ireland, I'm afraid to say.
Yes, of course,
and
yeah.
And that started 800 years ago. So we are the old enemy, although we're all friends now, as it happens. So,
right.
Weren't the Irish also the first to sort of rebel, really, and start the revolution against the British Empire?
Well, we were at it for several hundred years before anybody... But you're right, it was...
kind of implicitly, I suppose, the first to be occupied would be the first to start rebelling, I suppose.
In 1916, and part of the reason that the British government at the time was very reticent to let Ireland out of the empire was their argument was, if we let Ireland go, whatever will happen to India?
Yeah.
And of course they succeeded in holding on to India, because Ireland did eventually win independence in 1920.
But it was only about 30 years between the two, wasn't it?
Well, there was another world war, so you know, that did change the landscape appreciably, I think, at the time. But Ireland was the first to go, and we remained neutral during the Second World War, although we had and we still do in actual fact commit an awful lot of troops to the British Army, and
indeed,
you know, people from the Republic still come to Britain to join the army.
But the writing was on the wall, I think, from around about the 1880s in Ireland, and the Irish Land League, once they broke the power of the English landlords, you know, this, if, I mean, I don't want to lecture an Irishman on Irish history, but I mean, I think this isn't, don't you think, Billy, this is it was a big part of why the revolution happened over there in the early 1900s, was because the British had basically lost the stranglehold from land ownership on the ordinary Irish people in Southern Ireland in the 1880s through boycotting. You know, this is where the word boycott comes from. Captain Boycott, who was a rather nasty Englishman who got boycotted. And is it Michael Davitt, the Land League, and all that? And they used to have meetings up in the mountains, secret meetings in the middle of the night, you know, who, what are we going to do next to get rid of the power of these landlords? Because they were basically driving up the rents. And I mean, we were in a situation in the 1800s, what with the famine and stuff in Ireland, where you know, families were deliberately making their houses look like rat-infested hovels, so that when the factor came round from the landowner, the absentee British landowner, English landowner, that their houses would look so dreadful, they would think, "Oh, we can't increase the rent again." You know, so it was a horrible situation in Ireland, and I think, you know, it was just due to the ordinary Irish people that got together to say, we're not having any more of this, back in the 1880s, that meant that ultimately they got a bit of power back over the land, because what happened was the Irish MPs, because they're Ireland used to send MPs in the 1880s to Westminster, held the balance of power. A little bit like the Lib Dems do now, you know,
right.
And could actually, but mind you, they got a lot more out of it than the Lib Dems are.
Yeah.
And they instituted these Irish Land Acts in the 1880s, and slowly but surely, what happened was that these impoverished, poor tenant farmers in Southern Ireland managed to get loans, interest-free loans from the British government, and slowly but surely, right across Ireland, they were paying far less than they had been to these nasty landlords, but they owned their own land. Yes. And they had a loan to build a nice new house on it. So you had a real kind of freedom sort of land ownership, and people who were peasants turned into fairly prosperous small farmers right across Southern Ireland in the 1800s. And I think it was the Irish people getting a bit of power in that way that actually led to them thinking, right, okay, let's take over the government now rather than just a few fields. Yeah,
you're listening to the Arts Strand on Steve Sackshaw, BCFM. Well, no, we're Tony Gosley, but
strangely it's actually very important and significant, and it does tie in very heavily with the arts, because the land acts that Tony is referring to there, the Ashford, the Wyndham and the Balfour Land Acts, which took you right up until I think 1912 was the final Balfour Act, the second Balfour Act. Incidentally, Balfour is the same guy who signed the treaty in Jerusalem that sent, I can't remember his name offhand, basically it created all of the problems that we now have in the Middle East. But, you know, that's something for another day.
The Palestinian mandate and all that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, the granting of the hereditary land to the Zionists, the Zionist trend that was occurring across Europe at the time. Anyway, boring stuff. It's not boring, it's important. It does tie in with the resurgence in what essentially is weirdly this opposite side of the same coin, Tony, the renewed interest in the Irish literary movement. So you've got people like Oscar Wilde and a number of noted poets. And of course there's W.B. Yeats and Jack B. Yeats, his brother, a very eminent painter, and of course Bram Stoker and people like that. Bram Stoker slightly earlier, obviously, but there were a number of expatriate Irish Protestant literary figures who were kind of they were the educated, well-heeled Protestant side of the coin, but they were still delving back into the folkloric tales of Ireland to try and impress some form of ancient identity, and a bit like what Albert did with the Celts and the Tartan, I suppose, in Scotland, but to try and reinforce all of this back on to give the Irish people a sense of self.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't, it's very simple to say it was a sectarian conflict and it went back to the Act of Union in 1801, and then the Catholic Emancipation in 1829 didn't really do much for it either. But essentially, an awful lot of the Protestants in the country at the time didn't agree with how the Westminster government was treating the indigenous population either. So they were trying to instill some sense of nationhood in them, even from that stage. And an awful lot of the eminent politicians at the time, even the Home Rule politicians, Charles Stewart Parnell, for instance, and an awful lot of David's contemporaries in the Land League were also Protestant. So, you know, we can't go down that,
yeah,
that
it wasn't really such a sectarian thing. I remember seeing an engraving from the 1880s of this great meeting of hundreds and hundreds of people up in the mountains, you know, because they felt they couldn't meet in public, mm-hmm. you know, because otherwise the English landowners would find out what they were up to. And they were actually putting together, you know, big signs saying pay no rent. They would just simply say, rather than be totally impoverished by our rent, we're just simply not going to pay. Mm-hmm. End of story. You're not taking stuff off of our land to sell in the markets in London whilst we're starving, you know. This is and I think that whole business of the famine, the blowback was ultimately Home Rule, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And of course, because the population had been decimated, the landlords actually needed to cede to some of the requirements of what was left to work his land. The rest of the remaining people, like any famine, when your workforce is much diminished, then the workforce that remains have a stronger power base, I guess, because the work still needs to be done. There's just fewer people to do it, so you need to persuade them a little more strongly.
So whereabouts can we go to celebrate St. Patrick's Day then next week?
Well, there are a number of places. Bristol does very well for St. Patrick's Day, actually, because interestingly, because of Bristol's social history and the fact that it was a trading outpost, it does retain very, very strong links and has done for about 500 years with the south coast of Ireland. Cities like Cork, for instance, where I'm from, and also Waterford, the other great trading city on the south coast. cost. We had traditionally had a very strong relationship in Cork with Bristol. Even the coats of arms of the two cities are almost identical, because an awful lot of butter used to be exported from Cork, and Bristol was the point of entry into the UK for this butter, for instance. Also, the SS Great Britain, which everybody knows and loves, going back to the Sepoy Rising in 1857 in India, the SS Great Britain sailed from Cork with two regiments of Irish soldiers to go out and help quash the revolution. And also, of course, the SS Great Britain ran aground just south of Newry in County Down in 1861. So it hasn't had. But yes, there has been an Irish population in Bristol for about 450 years. And the area around the Christmas Steps now used to be the Irish ghetto at the beginning of the 1800s. Notwithstanding, of course, it was the Irish labour force who dug out what we now call the New Cut, running down between.
I was led to believe that it was Napoleonic prisoners of war who did all the work there. Is that right?
Well, you see, people always argue that. If it was Napoleonic prisoners of war, they wouldn't have thrown them a big party with free drink for a week, which culminated in riots. So, you know, there are two sides of... my suspicion is, because the Irish were here building the railways at the time anyway, and continuing to work on the canals and many other major engineering projects like that, there may have been some Napoleonic prisoners of war there, but I suspect not many, because you've been to France. They're a lazy breed. I mean, you know, they
won't...
That's
technically racist.
Yeah, but
Billy,
you know
it's like saying the Irish are stupid or they drink Guinness or whatever, you know.
I wouldn't disagree with that.
Well, they were liberated peasants in much more in France. I mean, people weren't used to just being told, you will do this for this tiny amount of money, whereas I think the Irish in Britain were, you know. So I want to get you round to tell us, where should we go if we want to have a really good St. Patrick's Day?